We're staying with the dominant theme of the day, in fact, of the month, and probably for the next couple of months as well. Professor Paddy Mallin is on the line. He's Professor of Microbial Diseases in the UCD School of Medicine and a consultant in infectious diseases at St. Vincent's Hospital, Vincent's University Hospital. Paddy, thanks indeed for coming on the programme again. You say the government should now consider closing our borders. To what extent and to what end?
So good morning, Sean. First up, I'd just like to clarify what it did say, which is very different from closing the borders. What it said is that we need to look at protecting our borders, which is a very different concept from closing. We need to look at protecting the gains that we've made over the last few weeks through all of the actions from both society and from the government level in terms of maintaining a very successful social and physical distancing policy within the country. And what that is doing at the community level is placing the maximum pressure on this virus to prevent it from circulating. And I think we'll see over the next couple of weeks just what effects that has had. And I think we're at a really critical time in terms of the evolution of this epidemic. But at the same time, we need to plan ahead. In the early post-epidemic phase, when we get over the hump of the infections and the presentations that we're dealing with at the moment, the next key step will be to try and avoid new infections coming into the country. And that's where you need to protect your border in terms of new infections coming in. And that'll be in the setting of the UK and the United States, two very common travel areas, are in a very, very different stage of this infection than we are. And we got to really critically look at our surrounding countries and try and reduce the impact of infections coming from those countries into Ireland.
Yeah, but how do you do that, Paddy, without actually closing the borders? How do you protect the border without closing it?
So the basic you got to work on a basic principle. The basic principle is how can you identify infections that are coming in and reduce the impact of them? So it's not about stopping flow of people, and it's not about stopping flow of goods. But what you want to do is to put definite measures in place that, at the very least, you're able to ensure that people coming into the country are abiding by the same restrictions that everyone else in the country is abiding by, and also actively case-finding new cases of COVID-19 when they do come into the country. And that will take a bit of a refocus of work away from what our public health are currently focused on at the minute, which is managing the epidemic in the country. But as that sort of starts to flatten out, there really will be an opportunity then to refocus on trying to prevent new infections coming in.
I suppose the only way you can be sure that you can achieve that end is to effectively put everybody who comes into the country into quarantine for 2 weeks, as opposed to asking them to self-isolate.
So there are a lot of different ways that you could do this. There are very drastic, draconian ways, which you've just referred to, and I'm not sure if that level of draconian measure will be necessary, but there's certainly a huge number of different measures that can be taken that would include active monitoring of people after they come into the country. There could be remote monitoring set up through apps where people have to report on symptoms or can report on their whereabouts after they come into the country. So there's a lot of different solutions that don't necessitate very draconian, almost sort of concentration camp solutions, which I don't think that people would really agree with. And I think we need to be innovative. We're an innovative country, but we need to be thinking about the concept that we're trying to achieve here. And it's not to isolate a huge number of people, but it's more to make sure that we just protect the gains that we've made and stop new infections coming in.
And do you see it in terms of gains having been made? I mean, for instance, the figures of the weekend, total cases yesterday, 2,615. Are you heartened by that?
I would be heartened to a certain extent, but the bottom line is we just don't know. I mean, everyone in the country for the last number of weeks has put a huge amount of effort and huge sacrifice and play here. And I'm not sure that we could be much better prepared than where we are at the moment, given our circumstances. And we just need to wait and see how this plays out. But the next 2 weeks, the next 2 to 3 weeks are going to be absolutely critical. I'm delighted that the government brought in the more significant restrictions when they did. I'm really delighted of coming to work this morning, seeing the guards on the N11 with checkpoints, and so enforcing these restrictions. So we've done a huge amount of work. we've got to sit back and wait and see what impact that has had. But we haven't been overrun yet. None of the hospitals have been overrun yet. And every day that that doesn't happen is a reassurance. But we just don't know. We've just got to sit tight and wait and see.
And the number of people in ICU settings, 88 yesterday. Again, what's your assessment of that?
What we're seeing, I think, across a number of the hospitals, definitely in the Dublin region where we're seeing most of the cases, is that people with COVID are coming into hospital. They're coming in and they're sick. They're requiring quite lengthy stays in hospital, and those that require to go to ICU are likely going to be in ICU for at least a number of days. So this is not a quick turnaround condition. And therefore, every day you will expect to see the number of people in ICU increase. But that doesn't mean that the ICUs are being overrun. And I think that's going to be a really important metric internationally, is when you look, the two metrics that I would advise people to focus on will be the death rates and the number of people in ICU. And the rate at which that doubles will really give us an early indication of how successful we are as compared to other countries. So in countries where the epidemic isn't that well controlled, you're seeing death rates doubling about every 2.5 days. And I think that if we start to see our death rates double at a slower pace, that will give us some early indication that the impact of this infection may be less in Ireland than what we're seeing elsewhere. But it's just too early to say.
Yes, at the present time, or up to the present time, some 43 deaths have been recorded, 88% of them linked to the coronavirus occurred in patients aged over 65. That's 38 of the 43. Yet there was one patient in the 45 to 54 category, two patients in the 55 to 64, and also there was one person died aged between 25 and 34, and another one aged between 35 and 44.
Yeah, so unfortunately, this is a condition that is affecting everyone in our society across all age groups, and that's something that we've always known. There's been a focus on trying to get the message out, particularly to older people and those that are more vulnerable, because we want to protect a flood of older, very sick people coming into the hospital. And I think that message has been very successful in the way that it's got out, because we're not seeing that at the coalface.
Yeah, Paddy, what about the fact that 506 of these cases are related to healthcare workers? And again, almost two-thirds of those had no history of foreign travel in the 14 days prior to the onset of symptoms.
So it is a concern. The hospitals around the country are losing workers. Some are being affected more so than others. Some hospitals have a lot of people out. Some other hospitals are able to manage with it. It's really that expectation of losing health workers that was behind the government's push to get more people to enter the healthcare service. And I'd imagine over the coming weeks that the majority of those people will be engaged in trying to help the health service through the next few weeks of crisis. In terms of the proportions and whether they're higher than the background population, the one thing to consider is that we're really focusing testing on healthcare workers. So there'll be a disproportionately higher number of healthcare workers tested than people in the general population. So that could artificially elevate those numbers and make it seem as if there is a crisis of transmission within the healthcare system.
Because
I don't know that that's the case.
Yeah, the percentages would be a lot higher than they are, for instance, in the UK or even in Italy, I think.
Yeah, but to give you an example of the UK, we really can't compare ourselves in any shape or form with the UK. The only way that you can get a test in the UK up until recently was if you presented to hospital sick. Now, we're not taking that approach. We have a much wider testing process. Now, it needs to improve even more than where we're at the moment. But we've been testing more people per capita than most European countries. We've been focusing testing on healthcare workers. So we're actually picking up healthcare workers, some of whom have very minimal symptoms or in the very early stages of infection. And a lot of other countries around the world simply aren't doing it, choosing not to do it, or they don't have the capability to do it. So we're a bit ahead of the game on that respect. And we're doing that specifically to try and enable our healthcare workers to work safely. And I think that needs to be the focus, because they're our most important resource.
Okay, Paddy, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Professor Paddy Mallin there of the UCD School of Medicine and also a consultant in infectious diseases at St. Vincent's University Hospital in Dublin. Direct provision centres have been described as powder kegs for COVID-19, but Fiona Finn, chief executive of NASC, that's the Migrant and Refugee Rights Centre, has said very little action has been taken to protect the lives of asylum seekers. She's on the line now. That particular reference about powder kegs was remarks by Dr. Eamon Fowler. He's another infectious disease specialist. He's a registrar at Cork University Hospital. Is that a view you would share?
Absolutely, Sean. We would absolutely share the view of Dr. Eamon Fowler. And I think the what's critical for us is you have people living in direct provision. There are 7,271 people currently living in kind of living very closely together in congregated settings. So hand hygiene, they're unable to self-isolate, and now people have been asked to cocoon, and it's become very, very, very unclear as to how people living in direct provision are able to cocoon. And we also have a very vulnerable population in direct provision, so we have people who are over the age of 60 and people who are at the at-risk category. And again, these people are living in impossible conditions now in direct provision, unable to protect their own health and the health and welfare of the residents around them. Now, we've been asking the Department of Justice for the last 3 to 4 weeks to move the vulnerable people out of direct provision. And we would also add to that that they need to move healthcare workers out of direct provision, because there's some incredible people working in direct, living in direct provision who are working in our healthcare sector. And we have heard there from your last caller the risk that healthcare workers are currently at with relation to in relation to COVID.
But are the alternative residences available for the people who are most at risk, in your view?
In our view, no. I mean, at the last briefing we had with the Department of Justice, which is on the 25th of March, we've been informed that all direct provision centres have been asked to provide 3 isolation facilities. Now, 3 isolation facilities, it might be fine if it's in a very small centre, but if you have centres where you have maybe 200 to 300 people, cannot see how 3 isolation centres will be sufficient. So, I mean, the concern and the worry that we have is that residents are really, they're trying their level best to work in line with the current guidance and with the current directions from the department, but they've been absolutely unable to do so. So their health is completely compromised in direct provision.
And would there be many people in direct provision, for instance, over the age of 70, to your knowledge, Fiona, who should be cocooning at this stage?
I mean, to our knowledge, I think we put, and again, this is just sort of from a very kind of back of the envelope kind of calculation, we reckon that there's probably about 100 people in direct provision that are over the age of 60. And then possibly another maybe 1,250 people that may have underlying health conditions. That's taking maybe 20% of the population. But the concern for us is the Department of Justice really haven't taken any action to even identify who these people particularly are, who these people that are at risk are, and that no measures to date have been taken to move those out and to create facilities to enable them to cocoon in a safe way.
And what about the number, or is there any significant number of centres, direct provision centres, where, for instance, people have own door facilities?
There are about 4, I think, in the whole kind of portfolio. So in all, there are 72 direct provision centres, and that's a combination of emergency centres, which are 33, and 39 direct provision centres. So of that, maybe 4 or 5 centres would have own door accommodation. And I think if ever people had any doubts about the inhumanity of direct provision, I think this actually is absolutely proof positive. And I think what is, for me, I mean, just completely, I suppose, upsetting and angering is that we believe that residents in direct provision have absolutely been left behind. I mean, it was only last Sunday, Minister Simon Harris, it was the first time we heard him mention residents in direct provision, aside from asking his call to ask people who are kind of healthcare professionals who are qualified in their own country and living in direct provision to come and help us tackle the virus. We're not safe unless and until we're all safe, Sean, and that's not the case.
Are you aware of any or many cases of COVID-19 in direct provision centres?
Now, we're only aware of 3 confirmed cases and 3 suspect cases. But again, we've, you know, it could be more than that.
And are you aware, or have you got assurances or looked for them about how those cases are being dealt with?
As far as we know, in one of the centres, it's the resident that has a confirmed case is able to self-isolate in that centre. And then in the other centres, the two confirmed cases have been removed from the direct provision centre. I mean, if we look at the homelessness sector, Sean, and if we look at, you know, only last week, they were able to secure 350 new units where vulnerable people, vulnerable homeless people have been moved out of homeless accommodation and moved into these units. The same thing hasn't been done for direct provision centres, for people living in direct provision. So if there's a willingness to do it, there's absolutely a way that it can be done.
Yeah, we know the HSE announced at the weekend, for instance, that the City West Hotel, the hotel there, it's on the outskirts of Dublin, will be used as an isolation facility for people with the illness. Now, presumably that will be extended and available to people in direct provision where necessary.
We haven't had confirmation of that. What we have heard from the department is that they were piloting an off-site isolation facility for people who become infected, who are living in direct provision. It may well be that the City West Centre is available to residents, we would hope, who are living in direct provision. We haven't had confirmation of that yet. However, I mean, what we need to look at here as well is prevention. Like, people cannot get to the point where the infection is spreading throughout the centres, and that's not happening.
Okay, look, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Fiona Finn there, Chief Executive of NASC, the Migrant and Refugee Rights Centre. We'll be talking about gorse fires after the break.